Welcome, welcome everyone to this segment of the Dave's Gone By radio program. My name is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am very, very thrilled to be talking to a Tony winner, a two-time Emmy winner, a Peabody Award winner, and also someone who sounds like a really nice and talented guy with tons of stories and anecdotes about his life in the theater and in television. His name is Martin Charnin. You know, the sun may come out tomorrow, but he's here with us coming out right now. So, Martin Charnin, shalom and welcome.
Well, I've never had an introduction like that before, I'll tell you that. That's amazing. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a machaya to have
you. Hello back to you.
So, thank you. Now, this is an exciting time for you because not only is Annie back on Broadway, but another show that you did on Broadway is being revived off-Broadway at the York Theatre Company. It was called 2x2. It's about one of my favorite things, the Bible. Please, tell us, how have you changed anything? Is it different from when it was on Broadway? Or is it... tell what you know.
Well, it's terribly different, but I hope a lot better. One of the... dreams that I had as a kid growing up in Manhattan was to write a musical with Richard Rodgers. And when I became a lyricist, this is in the late 50s, early 60s, I met Dick Rodgers, and I guess I didn't really have the credential to be able to ask him to collaborate with me. But ultimately, after working on several Broadway shows and getting some sort of a name for myself in television, I came up with the idea of doing a musical based on the Clifford Odets play, The Flowering Peach, which, in point of fact, was one of the first plays that I ever saw on Broadway when I was a kid. It was originally done as a straight play and starred that great Yiddish star Menashe Skolnick, and I believe Skolnick made his debut on Broadway in that role, in the role of Noah. And I was attracted to the piece for a lot of reasons, but mainly because Noah, as created by Odets, was a really feisty, intractable, screamingly funny patriarch of a very dysfunctional family, which reminded me, in I guess many, many ways, of my father.
Uh-huh.
And part of that image of Skolnick's portrayal of Noah, which interestingly enough is very much on the page. It's not only something that Skolnick was able to create, but he was really recreating what Odets had originally conceived. And it was, I guess, 1969 when I went to Dick Rodgers, and Oscar had died in 61 or 2.
Oscar Hammerstein, by the way, yes.
Yeah, Oscar Hammerstein had died, and Dick had had a series of collaborators. He'd written a show with himself called No Strings, and he'd written a show with Sheldon Harnick called Rex, and he had done one with Stephen Sondheim called Do I Hear a Waltz.
But they were all flops, unfortunately.
They were respectable shows. Waltz ran, I think, longer than any of those that I've mentioned. But nevertheless, in my opinion, it didn't matter about the length of time that any of the shows ran. What was important to me was the ability to collaborate with Rodgers.
Of course.
And through his daughter, Mary, with whom I had written the first musical I ever wrote in 1963, so 6 years later, I went brazenly, I suppose, to Dick and asked him whether or not he would be willing to collaborate on a musical, and he was delighted. He loved the idea. We went to Peter Stone, who was the wildly successful librettist. He had just won a Tony Award recently for 1776, which was a gigantic hit on Broadway. And the three of us embarked on adapting adapting the Odette's material and turning it into this musical. The other thing that was really attractive about it, it was sort of a precursor of where Broadway was going in terms of money and how expensive musicals were ultimately going to become. But this is only an 8-character play with 2 sets, so it was a forerunner of the smaller type of musicals as opposed to the extravaganzas. And the extravaganzas, of course, ended up costing 12, 13, 14, 15 million bucks, and certainly cost that now. I know that our production of Annie that's on Broadway right now is somewhere around $12 million.
Gewalt.
When I first directed Annie in 1977, which is 30 years ago, it only cost $800,000. So the costs have gone up considerably. But under any circumstances, I went to Dick and Peter and we sat down and had a grand time turning the Odette's play into a musical. The problem that we confronted was who was going to play Noah and who was going to be able to... I was fairly certain we would have no difficulty casting from the great talent pool in the country, particularly in New York City, the other role, Shem, Ham, Japheth, and the wives. But the role of Noah was the really complicated one, and needed somebody who could sing and dance and carry on and really be extremely funny and extremely touching.
You know, you should have gone with Menashe Skolnick again.
Well, I should have gone with the guy who sold bagels at the local bagel shop. The mistake was who was ultimately cast in the show, and while I do not want to disparage his memory, he was the reason that the thing didn't work.
We're talking, by the way, about Danny Kaye.
Originally.
What?
He was basically just a naughty boy, and it's pointless to, you know, speak ill of the dead, but...
Oh, go ahead, he's dead.
Didn't work.
Well, no, seriously, because I've read the stories about this, and I've read that he was really, really a bested and a terrible person to work with on that show for various reasons. I mean, Zero Mostel was a naughty boy, too, but they were able to corral him on some level.
Not only corral him, Zero had a great respect for material, whereas Danny believed that he was always bigger or better than the material that was provided for him to perform. So from Danny's standpoint, it was, I remember one early review in Boston when we were out of town trying it that said that Danny is performing the show as though it was beneath him. And so therefore he went excessively out of his way to ingratiate himself to the audience by going totally out of the play. And that was one of his great problems. He felt that unless we were giving, he was giving the audience 150% of that nonsense that he was able to do successfully on the screen, he wasn't giving them anything. So a lot of what we wrote instantly became magnified, blown up, out of proportion, totally unfunny, maybe... something that you do in the movies works in the movies because you can, if you don't like it, A, you can cut it, and B, you can shoot it again and then you get it right. Here in the stage, on the stage, you can't do that. But under any circumstances, that's the past, and the past is gone, and it won't come back, fortunately. And the other problem was, of course, the fact that Danny injured himself in the piece, and in the injury, the ticket sales just plummeted. We went from selling an inordinate sum of money, making an inordinate sum of money every week, to practically nothing, and had to kind of be held hostage by him by forcing him back into the play, which we did. And at the beginning, we thought, well, maybe the injury that he had to his broken ankle would make him behave, but Danny didn't know how to behave. So he did the first part of the show the first part of his return in a cast on his leg. But he was getting a lot of laughs off the cast, and so then he moved, when the cast was removed, he played it with crutches. And then finally, when the crutches were no longer necessary and the entire ankle had healed, he made us build him a wheelchair so he could tool around on the stage in a wheelchair, which he just thought was the most incredibly funny thing that had happened. And he ultimately just simply destroyed the piece. I do know that Dick and Peter and I never went back to see it after after Danny had done what he had done the third time. And it ran a year and a half based on the fact that people were not necessarily knowledgeable or knew what was going on, but they wanted to go see Danny Kaye because he had a gigantic reputation in films. And ultimately, it made a profit, believe it or not. The show ran over a year, and it was the only one of the post-Hammerstein musicals that ever made a profit for Dick, aside from obviously the revivals. But under any circumstances, it ended, it closed, and because of the stigma, because of the reputation that it had a terrible reputation back then, 40 years ago, we ended up not being able to make anything happen. Peter and I, Dick passed away in 78 or 9. I wrote another show with him, which also worked, which was a show called I Remember Mama.
And of course,
he went on to do a great many other musicals. I then did Annie and several other shows. But somewhere in the back of my mind was this incredibly riveting desire to get 2x2 on again and do it again and do it properly. And it's now taken us to this moment in time when I was able to find that Jason Alexander, from Seinfeld and many, many other shows, who is an old friend and a wonderfully talented, gifted actor, was also fond of the piece, knew about it. Not a lot of people did know about it, but Jason knew about it. He did it in a workshop situation in California 2 years ago. I went to see it, and I thought he was wonderful, and I said, if I ever get an opportunity to do it in New York, would you even consider coming to do it? Coming to do it for a limited period of time with the eye toward doing this production and then ultimately moving it on to do it as a revival on Broadway. And the moment occurred. The York Theater in St. Peter's Church on 54th Street in Manhattan called, offered me the slot that opened their series this year, and said that they wanted to do it, and indeed we are going to do it. I was also able to secure the services of an old friend and a wonderful actress named Tova Felcher.
Oh, of course.
Who is certainly well known to many audiences, not only Jewish audiences, but audiences all over the city and possibly even the world, to play the role of his wife. So Tova and Jason are going to be doing it. It's only for 5 performances.
Oh my God! Did it sell out the first second that you put the tickets out there?
Well, the tickets went on sale about 2 weeks ago, and I think there are maybe 15, 20 seats left for each one of the performances. It's only 5 performances, as I said.
Right.
But there are a couple of there are some seats left at for the performances at the York. It's on the 15th, 16th, and 17th of the Friday night, the 15th. Saturday, 2 performances, a matinee and an evening performance, and Sunday, 2 performances, a matinee and an evening performance. But it is not a full-bodied production by any stretch of the imagination. It is basically an opportunity to just reconnect to the material. Now, Peter Stone and I, about 2 years before Peter passed away, decided to go and re-attack 2x2, which is what we did, and we were able to rewrite the book.
Oh, so that's what I asked.
We reconceived it. So basically, it's a new production, a new revised production. It also includes 2 brand new songs that have never been heard before. Well, actually, they were heard. One was heard in Washington, in Boston, which is where we were out of town with the original production. It was a song for Ham. Danny, holding us hostage, said that nobody sings funny songs in this musical except me. So he forced us to cut it. So we had to cut that song. That never saw the light of day, but it's restored for this musical. And the new song was written for Tova because Tova didn't have enough material to do. The role of Esther, the wife, didn't have enough material to do. So she's gotten a new Rodgers song, which I only completed about a week and a half ago.
That's so amazing.
And now I'm finished.
Oh, well, hope you're finished now. Then now you'll see how it goes over those five performances. And then maybe you'll tinker a little bit more and then bring it perhaps back to Broadway.
That's the goal. I mean, there really is a goal. We want to get as many interested backers and producers to come and see the project and to examine it on its merits from a text standpoint and from a score standpoint. The whole idea being that it doesn't need any kind of gigantic production values, even though it doesn't need have animals and an ark and things like that. That's not what the play is about. The play is about his family and their relationship to God and to each other, and how Noah disputes the fact that God has chosen him to be the savior that he ends up being by making him build the ark. But then it becomes a very, very simple plot about fathers and sons. And that's basically what fathers, sons, mothers, daughters, the interrelationships that exist as frequently on, in Washington Heights and Rego Park and in Chicago and in Denver and maybe in Denmark as they did on the Ark. Hi, this is Martin Charnin, the lyricist and director of 2x2, which is going to be at the York Theater in February, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Well, you mentioned earlier that your father was something of that kind of personality, that character with your family. I mean, what was he like, and why was your family dysfunctional?
My father was an opera singer. He was the basso profundo with the Metropolitan.
Wow.
And I was a painter when I was growing up. I started, I went to the High School of Music and Art in Cooper Union. But I ended up going into the theater, and my father did not believe that the musical theater was anything like the high art that the opera was. And he never really liked the musical theater. So a lot of angst and service existed between he and me and my mother, who thought it was kind of a terrific thing that I was indeed in the theater. My first performance, the first thing and only thing that I ever did, was West Side Story, which is back in 1957. I was one of Jerome Robbins' original authentic juvenile delinquents. I was a jet.
You were a jet,
and,
right? Yes.
I was a jet. And
were you a jet all the way? No, just
all
kidding.
The way from day one, I was a jet.
And do you have any memories of being directed and choreographed by Jerome Robbins?
Well, I mean, Jerry was a taskmaster of the first order. I mean, he was extraordinarily talented and dictatorial. And while it was not easy to love him in any way, shape, or form, it was very, very easy to be in total awe of his gifts and his theatrical acumen. He was just a genius. There are or have been very, very few people who have even approached his ability and his knowledge of the theater and how he could make things work and how he was able to connect to the material that he was doing. I mean, Fiddler is extremely wonderful and beautiful, as on many, many, many of the shows and the dances that Jerry did. West Side, in my opinion, being the prime example of Jerry at his absolute best, where the language of dance ends up being as articulate and specific as the written word. And also, don't forget, I had Leonard Bernstein as the composer.
Of course.
I mean, he was the genius who created that score, which still to this day, given even the shows that I've written that I'm relatively fond of, just is the only musical that ever moves me the way any musical does. I mean, I still think it's just the greatest musical that's ever been written, and my instinct is that it will never be surpassed. So there's something amazingly iconic about West Side, and it was also an interesting circumstance where Gene Sondheim and Arthur Lawrence and Jerry and Lenny were together. They never wrote another show together. They never, those four gigantic egos and talents were never in a room together and doing anything else. So it was a very unique situation, and certainly one that I was very interested in learning about how it all worked, and paid strict attention to the way it was constructed, the way it was done, and how carefully every detail was the attention that was paid to every detail, from Jerry's standpoint, from Lenny's standpoint, from Arthur's standpoint, and from Stephen's standpoint. And truth be told, I mean, even there's never even been a revival that has approached what the original was. I mean, it is a landmark musical in the truest sense of the word. The way the original Oklahoma was a landmark musical, and all the revivals that try to improve it and make it better and make, you know, and adjust it, they're fixing things that aren't broken. And basically that's kind of the exact opposite of what I'm doing with 2x2. Because what I'm doing with 2x2 is fixing all the things that maybe were not broken when they were on the page, became broken when they went to the stage, and we went back to it with a vengeance and tried to correct as much as we can. The audience is going to give us a lot of answers in that five performance situation. It's a very small theater. It seats less than 200 people, and the tickets have, which only recently have gone on sale, went through the roof. So, as I said, there are only maybe, I don't know, 20 seats for each one of the performances left. But it's a wonderful opportunity. The more important thing being it an opportunity, which you don't get, to really have it in front of 1,000 people. I mean, five performances times 200 people is 1,000 people. So 1,000 people are like an exit poll at the ballot. You get a sampling and you kind of know which way the wind is blowing. So we get a lot of answers in those five performances.
Well, you have done quite a few musicals, and of them, only Annie kind of was the one that was this enormous monster success. 2x2, as you said, feels almost like a missed opportunity in its first go. Are there other musicals of yours, things like maybe La Strada or I Remember Mama or The First, others that you would go back to in the same way?
Well, I Remember Mama is being done. It's performed all over the country. It has a quiet little life. It's a small family musical. I wouldn't redo it. There's nothing to redo in it. It works as it works in the context of how it works. La Strada was a disaster. I was called in on the, they were out of town, and I was called in to make adjustments to it. But La Strada wasn't to be, mainly because La Strada as a play, as source material, in my opinion, wasn't really very musical. So I didn't know where we were. We were floating around trying to make it work. It didn't work, and it won't be revived, or it shouldn't be revived. As far as The First is concerned, And the first is a musical about the integration of baseball. It's a wonderful story of how Branch Rickey went to Jackie Robinson and how Jackie Robinson had to suffer all of those amazing and awful indignities as he changed the sport. So in theory, if the moment presented itself, I would go back and do it. But the big problem, the biggest problem about the first is the size of the cast. It was done in 1981, and at that time, you could hire as many people as we did indeed hire, and in order to make this musical work, you needed an entire African-American company along with a white company, because that's what the musical was about. So you couldn't do any doubling. And part of the horror of it is the relationship between the white players and fans and management and the black ball players. So it's a very expensive musical to do. So if some, you know, generous, brazen individual comes along and says, yes, I think it's important and I think it's significant enough to be redone, I would, in a heartbeat, go back and try and put it up again to make it work. I wouldn't change it, though. I mean, it's one of those interesting things. I'm not saying for a second that it's perfect. By no stretch of the imagination is anything perfect. I don't know. Maybe the Sistine Chapel is perfect. I really don't know. I've never really seen it. But my point is that the live theater, in the live theater, it changes. It changes actor to actor. It changes production to production. And it is alive. The theater is alive. And so the context in which you see things from show to show to show to show changes. Unlike film, where once you shoot it, it's eternal. It's on celluloid, and you're not going to be able to change it. You can remake it, but you can't change what the original was.
Now, speaking,
I wouldn't change it. I would maybe look at some of the musical numbers and change some of the orchestrations. I certainly would change some of the staging, because I've grown a great deal as a director, and I've learned a great deal more. And there might be a possibility to make some improvements from that standpoint. But I wouldn't change the text of the piece.
Can I ask you, you also mentioned about movies and not being able to change them, and what, not that it's a bad movie, but it did not capture, I guess, the stage magic of Annie. And then even you have said that somehow that was also a missed opportunity. What happened? Why didn't the movie Annie...
It was a bad movie. It was okay. Beyond a bad movie. First of all, mainly bad because I believe, as many people do, that the wrong people were attached to it. People without the kind of heart and soul that the piece needed. And Hollywood has a propensity, seemingly, to want to take Broadway shows and make them better. And invariably they fail unless the original authors are involved. And unfortunately, we sold the rights and gave up basically all creative control. Wow. It's something that I can never, I'll never do it again if I'm ever lucky enough to have that happen. But Annie is I'm blessed. I have created, I came up with an idea that became iconic. An iconic meaning, I mean, 35 years now that Annie has been running somewhere in the world, and they have been 28 languages. It's been done in 28 languages. They've made movies out of it. They've made television shows out of it. But she still survives, and the songs have lived. The songs have become some of the most recorded songs in American musical theater history. Tomorrow is up there in the top 10 of most sung songs of all time. So it becomes one of those moments where you get lucky really maybe once in your life, and that in point of fact is what Annie is. It's lovely, to have that happen. And my instinct is that iconography will last. It will go down along with The Wizard of Oz and Peter Pan and The Sound of Music. think it was one of the, you know, one of the Eternal Family pieces of all time. We go to the theater now and we see grandmothers who remember it from 30 years ago with their daughters and sons and whatnot who saw it 20 years ago, and they're now bringing their 10-year-olds to see it for the very first time. So it's generational. It's like a relay race. The baton, the anti-baton, is constantly being passed generation to generation to generation, as it is indeed with other shows like Sound of Music and Peter Pan and Fiddler, for that matter. Even productions of Fiddler, you know, they last and they have endured. And my hope is that Annie will keep on, you know, hanging around and last. And there will be a 50th anniversary production. I probably won't be around to see it, but if I am, I'll get there with my walker, and they'll give me a good seat in the front.
Now, the funny part about Annie, apparently, is when you were pitching it and trying to do it, a couple of Broadway musicals about cartoon characters and superheroes had flopped, so nobody wanted to touch it. Nobody was interested. And then you got Michael Price over at Goodspeed. Somehow he was the one who made the leap for it. Is that what happened?
Yeah, that's what happened. There had been cartoon musicals, Superman, Charlie Brown, Little Abner. They had been on Broadway, off Broadway. They sort of worked. Some of them failed. But the point was that I had a different approach when I read the comic strip and decided to see if I could get the rights to it from the Chicago Tribune. My approach to it was not to turn it into a camp musical or a farce. It was to do it for real. And Hal Gray, who is the genius who created it and who drew it for all the years that it was in the Chicago Tribune, never bothered to explain in any of the strips that went back to 1925 how or why Annie and Warbucks ever got together. So there was an opportunity for us to take and make an original statement. We used characters, but we didn't use any stories. We didn't have a story. But we wanted to make it happen, our musical happen during the course of the Depression. We wrote it in the 70s. We were in a relatively depressed state in the country at that time. We were being Nixonized and Watergate and Vietnam and a recession and God only knows what else was going on. And Annie's about optimism and hope and spunk and love and searching for something that you want and ultimately facing all kinds of adversity and finding it. And that's something that has sort of been a common thread from, you know, day one of history to now. Every now and again, you need to have someone come around and tap you on the shoulder and say, well, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. If we didn't believe it was going to get better, I think we would all jump into the ocean at this particular moment in time.
That's...
So Annie today feels like it was written for today. There's a line or a political position in that show that we didn't have in that show or have not had. We didn't make no adjustments. That's the script that 1971 and ultimately got on in 1977. Everybody believed that we were going to do a farce. You know, it was going to be Burt Ward and Nancy Walker making fun of those two cartoon characters. That was not what we wanted to do. I saw it as a much more Dickensian kind of piece, talking about ultimate truths in terms of human relationships, needs, wants, desires, and that was basically what we ended up putting on the stage. Hi, this is Martin Charnin, and you're listening to Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
I think it's great that you embrace your biggest hit. I mean, there are people who would say, like a pop star who is a one-trick wonder, let's say, a one-hit wonder, and they hate the song that made them millions of dollars and made them so famous. And they only wish, oh, I wish people would love my other songs, they're even better, and this and that. But you know, I love that you know that you wrote on some level an iconic masterpiece. You even told theater critic Robert Feldberg that you wouldn't mind being known as Martin Annie Charnin, because you got lucky. You know, it was wonderful.
No, I wouldn't. I really wouldn't. I mean, it was always Bob. Thanks for the memory, Hope. He never shied away from the fame and love that was created by the fact that he introduced that song and used it as his theme song. I mean, why people use anything as a theme song speaks to why, to some sense of pride that they must have in the fact that they've done something that the audience remembers. But then you go on and you learn other things about their career and their life and their attitude. If I'm lucky, and 2x2 works, it will ultimately, I believe, could become as important as a musical. Nothing's going to become as important as Annie. I had hoped over the course of the years that something might, but there's no way. And so I have put it away on a shelf and said, folks, there's Annie, and then there's the rest of whatever musical stuff I do.
Now,
Annie is Annie, and there's just no denying it. There are too many posters with too many companies and too many kids, you know, walking around singing those songs and wanting, you know, to come to Halloween parties in red dresses.
We are talking with Martin Charnin. He is, of course, the guy who conceived and wrote the lyrics for Annie, as well as a bunch of other shows. But let us not forget that you are also a director. And one.
Well, let us not forget that I directed 19 productions of it, including the one that came to Broadway and started the whole thing rolling. I did 5 national companies in the U.S., and then I did 3 revivals, and I did 3 productions in England, directed all of them, directed it in Dutch, in the Netherlands, and went to Canada and Spain, and I mean, I've done it and seen it in many configurations.
Can I ask then, in directing Annie over the years, were there things that you discovered, like 5, 10, 15 years into the process of directing it somewhere else, that you hadn't even thought about when you first directed it on Broadway?
Yeah, when I did it in Australia, for example, I did in 2000, I discovered that I thought that Warbucks didn't have enough to sing. And it turned out that the gentleman who played Daddy Warbucks, Anthony Warlow, who was an enormous singing star in Australia, also felt that way, and he said, could we write another song for him? And Charles Strauss and I sat down and we wrote another song for him, which he put into the show in Australia, and it worked wonderfully, and sang it brilliantly, and we recorded it there and everything. And then I figured, okay, well, here now is an opportunity when I do any other productions in the States or anywhere else to incorporate that song. And it turns out that I tried it, and in 2 productions here, and it didn't work at all. And the reason it didn't work was because he had written it specifically for Warlow. So those kinds of discoveries you make. You make the discovery that something that ended up being correct someplace ends up being incorrect someplace else. And you have to just keep your eyes open and make sure that you don't impose an idea that is organically someone else's or belongs to something else on the production. You have to pay attention to what you're doing, and whatever it is you're doing is what you have to honor, and that's how you get it done and make it work again.
I want to thank so much Martin Charnin. I want to wish him a big mazel, not only on the Annie that's on Broadway, but of course the 2x2 at the York Theater for 5 performances in the middle of February. Go see it if you can get those tickets that are remaining. And I just want to thank you so much for being so open and so true and so honest about your life in the theater. And thank you for being in the neighborhood with me.
Well, it was a great pleasure, and I really appreciate it. And I thank you. And the next time we talk, 2x2 will be on someplace, and maybe we can talk about that.
Halavai. Thank you, Martin.
Halavai. Thank you.